All right, so let's imagine you're a bartender. It's a Friday night, busy, music's going, the crowd's really lively. You're just trying to keep up with all the orders. And you notice someone at the bar, they seem a little off. Maybe they're talking a little loud, laughing a little too hard. Nothing too crazy, but something feels a little different. And then imagine that person leaves, gets behind the wheel, and causes a really bad accident. Could you, the bartender, actually be held responsible?
Yeah, that's the kind of question we're going to be diving into today, looking at a case out of Washington State that's got a lot of people in the legal world talking, especially people in the bar and restaurant industry. It's Barrett v. Lucky Seven Saloon.
And it really all comes down to how we define intoxication, right? Specifically, the difference between apparently under the influence versus obviously intoxicated. I think for a lot of us who aren't lawyers, those might sound like the same thing, but this case shows us that they're definitely not.
No, they're not. And that has some pretty huge potential implications for the hospitality industry. This case really forces us to look closely at what these phrases really mean and what they mean for liability.
Okay, so let's set the scene here. We're going back to October 11th, 1995. A man named Ned Marr goes to the Lucky Seven Saloon after work, spends about 3 hours there. And we know that he had at least two pitchers of beer. And remember, back then, the legal blood alcohol limit was 0.10%.
Yeah, and this is where the timeline becomes super important. So Marr leaves the saloon around 4:30 p.m., and sadly, on his way home, he falls asleep while driving, crosses the center line, and crashes head-on into another car, causing some very serious and lasting injuries to the driver, Jeffrey Barrett.
And so this sets the stage for what we call a dram shop case,
Right.
which is where the victim of a drunk driving accident sues the place that served the alcohol to the driver.
Exactly. So about 2 hours after this crash, Moore's blood alcohol content is measured at 0.13%, so already over the legal limit at the time.
And this is where it gets really interesting, because through expert testimony and what's called time-lapse BAC calculations, it was estimated that Marr's blood alcohol level was likely closer to 0.15% when the crash actually happened.
That's a huge detail. It really starts to paint a picture of just how intoxicated Marr might have been when he left the Lucky Seven Saloon. So Barrett, understandably, sues the saloon, arguing that they were negligent in serving Marr alcohol when he was already intoxicated.
So the case goes to trial, but here's where it takes a turn. The jury was told to use the obviously intoxicated standard to decide if the saloon was liable or not. And this standard, by the way, had been the norm in Washington for decades.
Right, and using that standard, the jury decided in favor of the saloon, finding they weren't negligent. So you might think case closed, right? Well, not quite.
Nope. Barrett appeals that decision, and this is where things really get interesting. He argues that the jury should have been told to use a different standard, a standard called apparently under the influence. And this phrase, apparently under the influence, is taken directly from Washington state law about selling alcohol.
And get this, in a 5-4 decision, the Washington Supreme Court agrees with Barrett. This is where things really start to change in the legal landscape.
So let's break this down a bit. What exactly is the difference between apparently under the influence and obviously intoxicated? And why did the court think this change was so important?
Okay, well, obviously intoxicated, as you can probably guess, involves those more obvious outward signs of being drunk, slurring your words, stumbling around, maybe being overly loud or disruptive. Apparently under the influence, on the other hand, implies, a kind of lower threshold. It might be more about subtle changes in behavior or coordination that aren't as easy to spot.
So is this new standard saying that bars are now responsible for catching those subtler signs, even if they're not super obvious? Like, how is a bartender supposed to catch those little cues in a busy bar that's packed and loud?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question, and it's got a lot of bar and restaurant owners feeling a little uneasy for sure. The court seems to be saying, yes, you have a responsibility to do more than just look for the most obvious signs. You need to be more in tune with even those subtle hints that someone might be impaired.
Wow. That's a pretty big change.
Yeah.
But this wasn't a unanimous decision, right? There were some of the justices who weren't really on board with this new standard.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There were some pretty strong dissenting opinions in this case. Some justices felt like this change was just too much too fast. They pointed out that the obviously intoxicated standard had been used in Washington for over 60 years. Why change it now?
So we've got this big shift in the legal world happening. And I imagine a lot of people in the industry are probably feeling a little anxious about it all. Like, what are the real-world implications? How does this actually change how bars and restaurants operate?
Well, one of the really fascinating things about this case is how the court used something called the restatement second of torts to justify its decision. Might sound kind of intimidating, but it's a pretty straightforward concept.
I'll admit, the restatement, whenever I hear that, it just makes me feel like I need to go back to law school. Can you maybe break that down a little, make it more accessible for those of us who aren't lawyers?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. So think of the restatement like a giant cookbook for judges. It's got recipes or legal tests, you could say, for how to approach these really tricky cases. And in this case, the court used one of these tests to figure out, you know, when a law should be used to hold someone accountable for causing harm.
So it's not enough that the law's on the books. They actually have to connect it to this specific situation with the bartender and the drunk driver.
Right, exactly. So the test they used had four parts. The first part looked at whether the law was intended to protect a group of people that included Barrett. And in this case, that group was basically motorists or anyone who could be injured by a drunk driver.
Which Barrett, as the victim of a drunk driving accident, would definitely fall under. Okay, so what's next?
So then the second part of the test asks if the law was meant to protect the particular thing that was harmed. And here, that was safety from drunk drivers.
Okay, so the law is designed to protect people like Barrett, and it's meant to protect them from the exact type of harm that he suffered. Gotcha. What about the last two parts?
Yeah, so the third part looked at the kind of harm the law was trying to prevent. So in this case, physical injuries from a drunk driving accident. And then the last part looked at whether the law was specifically designed to protect against the danger that actually caused the harm, which, you guessed it, drunk driving.
So basically, the court went through this legal checklist and said, yep, all the boxes are checked. This law was made to protect people like Barrett from ending up in the exact situation he found himself in.
Exactly. And that's how they justified using the apparently under the influence standard instead of the obviously intoxicated standard. They argued that the new standard better matched what lawmakers actually intended when they wrote the law to protect people from the dangers of drunk driving.
But even with this test, it sounds like not all the justices were totally convinced. What were some of the arguments that those who disagreed with the majority opinion, what did they have to say?
Well, Justice Sanders, who wrote one of the dissents, he had a couple of big points. First, he argued that Barrett's lawyers kind of missed their chance to object to the jury instructions back at the original trial. He basically said, look, you snooze, you lose. Like, they should have brought up this apparently under the influence standard back then. And since they didn't, it shouldn't be considered now on appeal.
Oh, so he was saying it was too late to introduce this new standard. Interesting.
Exactly. It was a procedural thing. But even putting that aside, he also just straight up disagreed with the idea of switching to this new standard. He said that changing from obviously intoxicated now, after using it for so long, would just cause confusion and inconsistencies in the law.
Yeah.
He was worried about having like two different standards depending on the specifics of the case, you know?
I could see how that would be a problem. If it's not super clear what the difference between these two standards is, it could lead to a lot of uncertainty for bars and restaurants and probably a lot more lawsuits, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And Justice Sanders also brought up another point that I thought was really interesting. He said that historically, these kinds of cases have focused on the person being served the alcohol, you know, were they obviously intoxicated? It wasn't really about the server's ability to notice these smaller signs.
So he's basically saying, hey, we can't expect bartenders to be mind readers, can we? They can't be responsible for figuring out what's going on in someone's head, right?
That's one way to look at it. Yeah, he argued that this new standard places an unreasonable burden on these businesses. Like, they're being asked to guess what's happening inside someone's head based on these subtle things that could be totally misinterpreted.
And I'm guessing his concerns resonated with some of the other justices, too, even the ones who ended up voting to send the case back for another trial.
Oh, yeah, for sure. In fact, two other justices agreed that the case should be retried, but they actually sided with Justice Sanders on the whole obviously intoxicated standard being the right one. It's kind of a twist.
Wait, so they agreed with the outcome, but not with how the majority got there. Why is that?
Well, Justice Bridge, his focus was more on the procedure. He agreed that Barrett's team had done what they needed to do to bring up this argument on appeal. But he also agreed with Justice Sanders that obviously intoxicated was the right standard to use all along. But Justice Madsen, she looked at it a little differently. She basically said that for Barrett to get a new trial, he needed to show that he was actually harmed by the jury getting instructions about obviously intoxicated. She argued that he hadn't really demonstrated how that actually impacted his case. So she was essentially saying, even if they had been told to use the apparently under the influence standard, the jury still might have come to the same conclusion.
Wow. So even within the group that wanted to retry the case, there was this disagreement about the main issue.
Yeah.
Which standard should be used? Man, this case really is like peeling back the layers of an onion. The deeper you go, the more complicated it gets.
Yeah, it really is. And you got to remember, this was a 5-4 decision. It was really close. And that just shows how much disagreement there is about this issue.
Okay, so after all this back and forth, what's the bottom line here? Did the court actually say that bars and restaurants are now responsible for missing those more subtle signs of intoxication?
Well, they didn't come right out and say it, but that's exactly what a lot of people in the industry are worried about, because this decision leaves a lot of things unclear, and it's probably going to take more court cases, maybe even more appeals, to figure out exactly how this new standard is going to be used in practice.
I bet this case is already having an effect on how bars and restaurants train their employees and how they approach serving alcohol in general.
Oh, absolutely. We're already seeing a move towards more in-depth training programs with a lot more focus on spotting those less obvious signs of impairment. It's not just about looking for the classic stumbling drunk anymore. Employees are now being trained to pay attention to things like slurred speech, changes in how someone moves, even shifts in their mood, stuff that could indicate that someone's apparently under the influence.
That makes sense, but how do you even go about standardizing that kind of training?
Yeah.
Everyone's different, right? What might be a red flag for one person could be totally normal for someone else.
You're exactly right. That's the real challenge here. And it's a big part of why this new standard is causing so much debate. It relies a lot on individual judgment. What one person sees as apparent impairment might not seem that way to someone else. And that's going to make these cases really difficult to argue in court.
Yeah, sounds like it could easily become a lot of he said, she said kind of situations. And I bet we're going to see a lot more experts being brought in to testify, especially about things like blood alcohol levels and how they affect people's behavior.
Absolutely. And remember that detail about Mara's blood alcohol level being 0.13% 2 hours after the crash? That kind of evidence, combined with expert testimony on things like those time-lapse BAC calculations, that's going to become even more critical in these cases going forward.
It really does feel like this ruling has kind of created a whole new arena for legal battles about how we define and prove intoxication.
Yeah, it really has. And it's not just about who's liable anymore. This case could actually end up changing how we think about drinking as a whole.
Okay, now I'm really intrigued. How so?
Well, think about it. If bars and restaurants have to meet this higher standard, they're probably going to be a lot more careful about who they serve and how much they serve them. We might see stricter ID checks, limits on how many drinks someone can buy, maybe even earlier closing times.
So it's kind of like a ripple effect that goes way beyond just the courtroom. It could affect all of us.
Exactly. This case really shows how one legal decision can trigger all these changes in what we consider normal and how we behave. It's a super fascinating and complex issue with some potentially huge consequences.
So welcome back. We've been talking about this big Washington State case, Barrett v. Lucky 7 Saloon, and how it's really changing things up legally for bars, restaurants, anyone who serves alcohol, really.
And I think what makes this case so interesting is that it's not just some theoretical legal debate. It could actually change how we think about drinking, you know, personal responsibility and the duty that businesses have to keep the public safe.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we've gone over all the arguments, the dissenting opinions, that legal test from the restatement. But let's get down to brass tacks. What does this ruling actually mean for people out there in the real world? Like, what are the actual concrete consequences?
Well, I think one thing is that it could make it a little bit easier for people to win these types of lawsuits. You know, before, under that old obviously intoxicated standard, you really had to have those clear, undeniable signs of drunkenness. But now with this apparently under the influence standard, it might be a little easier to prove your case. Even small changes in behavior, things that a bartender might easily miss in a busy bar, those could now be used as evidence.
So we might see a lot more lawsuits against bars and restaurants.
Yeah, it's possible. And it's something that a lot of people in the industry are definitely worried about. They're under a lot more scrutiny now, and the potential for getting sued is definitely higher.
I can imagine. So what kind of changes are we likely to see in the way bars and restaurants actually do business?
Well, we're already seeing a shift towards more intense training for staff. There's much more of a focus on teaching them how to recognize those subtle signs of impairment. You know, it's not enough anymore to just be on the lookout for the stereotypical stumbling drunk. Now they're being trained to notice things like slurred speech, changes in coordination, even shifts in mood that could suggest someone's apparently under the influence.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. But honestly, it seems kind of impossible. Like, everyone reacts differently, right?
Huh?
What might be a big red flag for one person could be completely normal for someone else.
Mm.
How do you even create a training program for that when it's so subjective?
You're right, that is the big challenge. And it's one of the main reasons why this new standard is so controversial. There's a lot of gray area. What seems like apparent impairment to one person might not seem that way to another. And that's going to make these cases really hard to decide in court.
Yeah, it sounds like it could easily turn into a lot of he said, she said.
Mm.
And I bet we're going to be seeing a lot more expert witnesses, especially people who can talk about blood alcohol content and how it affects behavior.
Oh, absolutely. You know, we talked earlier about Mars blood alcohol level being 0.13% 2 hours after the accident. That kind of forensic evidence, along with expert testimony about things like those time-lapse BAC calculations, that's all going to be even more important in these cases moving forward.
It really seems like this case has opened up a whole new legal battleground around how we define and prove intoxication.
Yeah, it has. And it's not just about liability anymore. This case could end up changing our whole drinking culture. Well, just think about it. If bars and restaurants are being held to this higher standard, they're going to be a lot more careful about who they serve and how much they serve them. We might see stricter ID checks, limits on how many drinks you can buy, maybe even places closing earlier.
So it's like this ripple effect that goes way beyond the courtroom. It could affect our everyday lives.
Exactly. This case is a great example of how one court decision can trigger all these changes in what we consider normal and how we behave. It's a fascinating issue, so complex, with some really big potential consequences.
It definitely is, and it's given us a lot to think about. What would you say is the most important takeaway from all of this?
For me, it's that the court is putting a lot of emphasis on foreseeability. They're basically saying that bars and restaurants have a duty to anticipate the possible consequences of serving someone who might be impaired, even if the signs aren't super obvious. And that responsibility goes beyond just the person they're serving. It's about protecting everyone.
It really makes you think. It emphasizes how much responsibility comes with serving alcohol.
It does. And it also makes you think about the balance between individual responsibility and the role of businesses in preventing harm. It's a tricky issue.
For sure. Any final thoughts for our listeners who are still trying to wrap their heads around all of this?
I'd say that Barrett v. Lucky 7 Saloon is more than just a case. It's a wake-up call for all of us. It reminds us that even subtle signs of impairment can have really serious consequences. And it challenges all of us, whether we're business owners, servers, or just people who like to go out for a drink, to be more aware and responsible when it comes to alcohol.
That's a great point. And on that note, I think we'll wrap things up. But to all our listeners out there, we'll leave you with this. Imagine you're that bartender. It's a busy Friday night and you're watching your customers trying to figure out if they've had too much. How would you define apparently under the influence? Where do you draw the line? What would you do if you were the one working at the Lucky 7 Saloon that night? It's tough. There are no easy answers, but it's a conversation we need to keep having. Thanks for joining us for the deep dive.